This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Hey. Welcome to the Santita Jackson Show. I am back. Happy Labor Day weekend. I hope you all had a wonderful weekend. It is Thursday, September 9th, 2021. I'm Santita Jackson. It's the Santita Jackson Show, coming to you from WCPT 820, the nation's largest progressive talk radio station, based here in Chicago, and AM 950 Radio, the voice of progressive Minnesota. I want you to meet my morning stars, Linda and Dave and Raphael down there in Brazil, and Frances and Joyce and Daphne and everybody on the Santita Jackson and Friends page, the Santita Jackson and Friends page on Facebook and on Instagram, Santita Jackson IG, and on Twitter, at Santita J. Everybody, please like and friend me. And of course, we're on YouTube on the Santita Jackson Show YouTube channel. Got a lot to talk about today, and we're going to have some wonderful guests who are going to talk with us about the economy. Of course, Dr. Max Wolf, productivity and jobs. We're seeing rising hunger. We're seeing more and more people moving away from the jobs that they had before. What's going on with that? What about product? Why is it that fewer workers are needed to produce more? There's a lot to talk about with Dr. Wolf. And, of course, David Daley is going to be discussing what's happening in Texas. Are the Democrats really going to push back on voting rights, on the abridgments to women's reproductive rights? They raise a lot of money when these decisions are made, but we're not seeing a lot of action. So we got to talk about that today. And then Dylan Roof, the young man who killed all of those worshipers at Mother Bethel AME in Charleston, South Carolina, several years ago. He was sentenced to death, and he feels that the people who were killed were portrayed too sympathetically. So that is the basis of his appeal. We got a lot to talk about. Of course, Dr. Deborah Verholden is going to give us the latest on COVID-19, and Pastor Darius Brooks will give us some good news. So let's get right to it today, everybody. I want to hear your voices. Call me at 773-763-9278, 773-763-9278. I missed you too, Joyce, and everybody. I really did. 773-763-9278. I want you to text me there as well. GWC Injury Lawyers gives you the opportunity to do that. And I also want to thank you for all of your prayers. Many of you heard my mother was relayed, our mother, she has five kids, was released from the hospital on Friday. And what a joyous homecoming it was. We still have to be very careful. She's still in recovery, but boy, oh boy, we're so blessed to have our mother home and getting stronger every day. And so, you, as the Bible tells us, the prayers of the righteous availeth much. And for those of you who don't have a religious or faith commitment, you could be agnostic, you could be atheist, we felt your warm energy. We felt that. And that means a whole lot. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart and from the hearts of our whole family. Our father's in rehab, and they're both COVID negative. It's just a great, 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 great thing. So sending you much love and much appreciation for all of the love that you have given to our family. Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And thank you for helping me to get through those couple of weeks because it was tough. But, you know, that's life. It is life. Thursday, September 9th, 2020. Let us get to some of these headlines. Chicago, it's going to be cool. I think the fall is coming, everybody. 73 degrees will be our high today in Chicago. It will be mostly sunny. A beautiful day. Minneapolis, St. Paul, 76 degrees. That will be the high, mostly sunny. The Dow closed down 68 points yesterday. The NASDAQ closed down 87 points. And the S&P 500 closed down 5. The NFL season kicks off, everybody. Tampa Bay defending their Super Bowl championship. Full stadium they will have. That's going to happen tonight. But the Twins, well, they were triumphant over Cleveland, 3-0 shutout. The Cubs triumphant over Cincinnati, 4-1. But the Sox fell to the Oakland A's. Can't win them all, everybody. 5-1. Child hospitalizations, everybody, are up in the United States due to COVID. President Biden is expected to unveil a plan that will push for a new vaccine that will push for new vaccine mandates all across the country. Indeed, Los Angeles is set to impose vaccine mandates on children. And we want to know what you think about that. 773-763-9278, 773-763-WCPT. The administration's six-pronged plan will focus on vaccinating the unvaccinated, further protecting the vaccinated through booster shots, as more and more of the vaccinated are getting breakthrough viruses. Everybody, we've got to take care of ourselves, as we see that the daily U.S. COVID cases are up more than 300% from Labor Day last year. What is going on, everybody? What is going on? We've got to take care of ourselves. New Orleans has lifted the curfew imposed after Hurricane Ida, as electricity has been restored to most of the city. Across Louisiana, however, more than 240,000 customers are still in the dark. 38 million Americans are facing food insecurity. That is the bad news. Hunger has increased by nearly 9% since 2020, since the advent of this pandemic. More than 38.2 million Americans struggled with hunger. Hunger, that's what they're calling food insecurity. It's hunger, everybody. At some point last year, a roughly 9% surge, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. House Democrats are now pushing the Department of Justice to prosecute vigilantes who are enforcing the anti-choice law in Texas. As many of you remember, any person can enforce this law that denies women the right to reproductive choice. And many people are saying that this could encourage vigilantism. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland's pledge that he would explore all options to challenge this law. Well, now there are at least 24 Democratic lawmakers, led by House Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler from New York, Democrat from New York, calling on him to use the full power of his office to defend a woman's constitutional right and to defend these women against vigilantes. The top 1% have dodged $163 billion in taxes each year. Let's get to Pastor Darius Brooks, the brilliant psalmist, about we need some good news today. Pastor Brooks, what's on your mind?
Santina Jackson, first of daddy and mama have six kids. I'm Darius Brooks. I'm the other one. Don't leave me out no more, number one. And I'm so excited to say and believers have a faith, not a religious place. Believers have a faith, not a religious place. Isaiah 40 and 31 says, they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up on wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Santita, if I had to use for a thought today, what's worse than waiting on God is wishing you had. What's worse than waiting on God is wishing you have. Santita, because we're designed in his image and his imagination, meaning he has the plan. And the reason he says we are fearfully and wonderfully made is because he is a promise keeper, not a joke or a game, based on how he has everything beautifully designed. Santita Jackson has a character, a faith, a person, and a plan connected to her name. Santita Jackson has a character, a faith, a person, and a plan connected to her name. Jesse Jackson has a faith, a character, a person, and a plan connected to his name. You just got to talk about mama being home. You know why? Because mama has a character, a faith, and a person, and a plan connected to her name. And what patience does is gives you and me the ability to see the opportunity that God gives answers that I need this design for me, and that you need this design for you. That's a part of his plan. We're in a corporate world, a corporate church. We're in dysfunctional families. We're in political climates, and all of our stories are different, but we share the same pain. It's called hurt. But when we process God's word in our hearts, which is what this word patience means right here, God gives private lessons with great direction. Private lessons with great direction. And he works all things together for the good at the end. You don't have to wait on God wishing you had. Your success is in the process of his word. There is a promise that when you wait on God, You shall renew your strength. You shall mount up on wings of eagles. You shall run and not be weary. You shall walk and not faint. My wife asked me the other day, where do you get your energy from? I said, God's word. And people, he's not a God that he should lie. Trust him for the process for your success.
Amen to that. I love that. Being patient, everybody, because we certainly do want things to run in our time. You know, we really, really do. And that is just not the way that it works. It doesn't work.
Not at all, Cynthia. Nope. Everything has a plan. Mm-hmm. Even crooks got a plan to rob.
Even crooks have a plan to rob. Thank you so much.
They got to be patient with a plan to rob. Yeah. And we have a plan as believers that God's going to turn everything out. Look at mommy. Home safe, look at daddy. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. He has a plan. And I don't know who you are, but God's will is what's best for me. And I'm staying in his will, which is his plan. He says, I'll make all things beautiful in my own time. Y'all trust him. He's an amazing God.
Well, amen to that. But, you know, I tell you what, one of my takeaways from, certainly one of the takeaways I would say that from my whole family over the past couple of weeks, our parents received excellent health care, and they're still receiving that, which is a blessing. Too few Americans have access to that. Too few people in the world have access to that. And so as we fight for vaccine equity, as we fight for that, I think that what we need to do is also fight for access to therapeutics, to medicines. I was watching CNN this morning, and Pastor Brooks, they were talking about, you know, this is one of the states where you have a high number of people who've refused for various reasons not to get vaccinated, not to get these shots. And so, it, interestingly enough, they did not approach these patients. One woman who was in her 60s and she had been on a ventilator. They did not approach her disrespectfully, you know, pound her. Why didn't you get the vaccine? She said, my husband, they didn't do that. She said, my husband and I talked about it. We decided not to do it. But what they're now doing in Kentucky, they're actually going to the homes of people who have COVID and they're offering them treatment, the monoclonal antibody treatments. And one of the things that I want for all of us, I want to see them do that in Inglewood. I want to see them do that on the West Side. I want to see them do that in Compton. I want to see them do it in the poorest areas throughout Appalachia. Black, white, brown, yellow, and red. We all deserve the opportunity to get well. And so as we are fighting for access to vaccines, that's important. I think we need to be fighting for access to good food, to vitamins, to that which can boost our immune systems. But Darius Brooks, and you know because you work with a range of people, you work with people who are affluent, people who have money, who are comfortable. You work with people who are poor. You work with people who have fallen into the margins of the world. If you get sick, you should be afforded the opportunity and access, equal access, to the medicines that can bring you through COVID. I'm hoping somebody hears me today, because that is why we've had Dr. Deborah Verholden on here. That is why we...
And Santita, in addition to Dr. Deborah Verholden, you and me, I love the word. He says, where there's unity, there is strength. Santita, we got to get a mechanism or a situation or a organization that we come together to make it happen. Because we're talking individually. Mm-hmm. I wish I could find some pastors, and maybe this can be a topic on your show, that we can all come together. Not for the church stuff, but for what you just said right there, that we can fight for a common cause.
But that is the church stuff. That is the church stuff. Jesus was very real.
Yeah.
Jesus was very real, and Jesus dealt with real issues. Jesus was killed by the state because he was dealing with real issues.
Religious stuff.
But you know, but that's other people's stuff. What is religious is making sure that you set the captive free, that you heal the brokenhearted. Mm-hmm. That's religious, too. And I have a religious zeal about doing that every day. People have perverted what Jesus and what the great spiritual teachers have taught, have come here to teach us. And we need to stop that. Mm-hmm. And you're not responsible for that. I want to just stay right here. We've got Dr. Deborah Verholden on with us. And we got a lot going on today, Dr. Deb. You got about 8 minutes. what do you want to concentrate on? We're seeing a spike since last year. You said this was going to happen. 300%. COVID is up 300% since Labor Day last year. And now we're seeing more and more mandates. The president is going to speak to he's going to speak to COVID today because we're just seeing more and more people who have it. I was talking about something I saw in Kentucky. You see, they were talking to the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. And this one woman who was vaccinated got COVID. She said, look, everybody's getting it around here. Oh, where do you want to begin, Dr. Deborah Froholden?
Well, this is what we're seeing in all communities, my community being no exception. And the numbers are going up. We are on our ninth consecutive week of increase in my county, in Genesee County, which also includes Flint, Michigan. People talked a lot about the double pandemic of racism and COVID. Well, we've got racism, COVID, and all of the still remnants left from the Flint water crisis. And a community that's been very traumatized by that. And I know we're not the only community that faces those struggles. And so that thing that I find really interesting, and you remember, I've been saying this for a while, about 3 months into our pandemic response, when I started to see states, 3-4 months in, when states started to reopen and relax restrictions, I said, if they reopen and relax restrictions, we'll never eradicate this thing. The eradication bus has left. That train has left the station, the one where we can get rid of COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19 in the population. That train has left the station. We are now simply trying to mitigate the impact of COVID and reduce the spread and reduce the number of cases. And I've said that we have moved now from eradication to mitigation. And I really hope that people understand that. Allowing the virus to mutate as much as it did, having these half-baked prevention measures, adding one additional layer of protection while simultaneously removing other layers of protection, mm-hmm. had us miss the eradication train. And we're now focused primarily on mitigation and trying to prevent spread and severe illness and death.
Well, will that prevent death? That is my question for you. I was reading an article on Vox. America needs to decide how much COVID-19 risk it will tolerate. They're saying what you're saying, that we missed that window to eradicate it. Now we've got to mitigate it. What does that mean?
Well, in order for us to have gotten rid of it, we would have had to not let it take hold. Right. And so there are countries where they haven't had, I think it was Sweden or Switzerland. I can't remember what one of them hadn't had one case in 6 months, not one case. And then they got one case in the country and they shut the whole country down for 10 days because they said that if there's any other cases, we don't want those cases to have the opportunity to spread. We are not even close to taking those types of proactive measures. We've never had a national mask mandate. You know, I don't think, and somebody asked me, do you think we need to mandate the vaccine? And here's what I tell them. I know if we do mandate the vaccine, it's going to make a difference. See, people are holding on to the argument that, well, you know, I know a lot of people who've gotten the vaccine and still got COVID. People are holding on to this argument about people who've been vaccinated can carry the same viral load as people who are unvaccinated. And there's some truth in both of those things, okay? So you can, you will, the vaccine will not sanitize your airway. So your nasal passage in your throat, it won't sanitize those. So if you breathe COVID in, you might get some proliferation of the virus in that passageway. And you can breathe it in, you can breathe it out. You might even, especially because of variants, right? So the vaccine was designed to help your body build an immune response to what we call the alpha strains, the original strains of COVID. And now we've got, you know, thousands of variants. And it might not be, and it looks like it's not as good as protecting you from those strains. But it has given your body a really strong running start. That's why we say what it will do for most people is prevent clinically relevant symptoms and prevent hospitalization and greatly reduce and prevent the risk of death. What I try to explain to people is COVID wreaks havoc on your body. a very dear friend of mine here. She's the founder of a local newspaper, and she's just phenomenal. Her and I have been talking a lot. She's sort of listened in on a lot of the conversations that I've had with people in community. We've been doing, you know, for months, you know, every week, sometimes twice a week, I would do these virtual sessions with other experts, local, nationally, internationally, just trying to get people in my community the best information that I could get them. And she remained a no for the vaccine. Her mother did get the vaccine. She's 2 years younger than I am. So I'm 47, she's 45. Her mother got the vaccine. She and none of her family did. Well, her daughter contracted COVID. Her daughter's a teenager, likely picked it up in school because the kids are back in school. So that's a whole nother issue, because this is exactly what we knew would happen. The kids are going to get COVID. They're going to bring it home. So my friend got COVID and her mom got COVID. Now, her mom is 25 years her senior. Her mom is close to 70 years old. Her mother had very low grade symptoms. And the biggest issue that she dealt with was she had the fatigue for 3 or 4 days. My friend was down for 10 days, had to be hospitalized, and almost had to go on a ventilator before she started to turn the corner. Like, down, couldn't move for 10 days. She's 45 years old and otherwise in good health. She's now back home. She's dealing with long COVID now. And we don't understand why some people deal with it and some people don't. So she's in the midst of a battery of tests because, boy, did COVID wreak havoc on her body. Her kidneys aren't functioning well. This is a woman who never had a problem with her kidneys before now. This is a woman who's a vegetarian and had a very clean diet. You know, not the vegetarian that just eats everything minus the meat. No, like really proactive about her health. A very holistic, whole foods-based diet, and she's dealing with now long COVID. Her mother was down for really fatigued for 3 days, seemingly has no symptoms, and has returned back to normal. My friend still does not have her sense of taste and smell back. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's like, you know, these long-term lingering effects, we don't know who that will hit and who it won't. So the question really is, and it was a great article, how much are we willing to tolerate? How many more unnecessary deaths? How many more long COVID cases? You know, it's because the answer to solve this, people don't want to hear.
Well, you know what?
They don't want to hear it.
Let me tell you, when you come back tomorrow, I want to take more time with you so that you can explain what COVID actually is. I think we need to distinguish between the coronavirus, right, that yields COVID-19. Because, you know, you've been able to break this down for us. That's what we need. That's what we need. We need to know what we're looking at. Most of us, we don't know what we're looking at. You know, you give us something, a new perspective every day. It's called information. Dr. Deborah Holden, epidemiologist, associate dean of public health at Michigan State University. Our girl right here, our own Dr. Deb on the Santita Jackson Show. Back in just a minute.
We've got to change our head.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Santita Jackson Show. Of course, we're going to have Dr. Max Wolf on talking to us about productivity and jobs. So many Americans are not going back to these jobs. And, you know, they say that the minimum wage ought to be $26. It's way below that. What is going on? And why is it that fewer workers are producing more? How does that work? Productivity and jobs. And then David Daley is going to be talking to us what's happening in Texas. The attack on reproductive rights, the attack on the vote. The Democrats said that they were going to mount a challenge to it. Are they doing it? Let's talk about that. 773-763-9278. You remember, of course, in 2017, the tragic shooting at Mother Bethel AME, one of the iconic churches in the United States of America, rooted in the African-American tradition, Pastor Clementa Pinckney, a rising superstar in South Carolina politics, young African-American man. Many expected him to become governor in short order. Well, he was pastoring a Wednesday night church service, as many of us have attended down through the years. And this young man was sitting in the back, and he walked in. They welcomed him in. He had been casing the place, if you will. And he sat and he drank from a bottle of Smirnoff. And he kept thinking, I've got to shoot these people. Now, mind you, they welcomed him into the prayer group. And you had an elderly minister. You had eight women, according to this this news report. One young man, a little girl. But to him, the story continues, they were a problem. He believed, as black Americans, they were raping, quote, our women and taking over our country, close quote. So he took out his Glock handgun and calmly, while their eyes were closed in prayer, opened fire on 12 people gathered in the basement and shot almost every single one of them dead. So now he's been sentenced to the death penalty. But he believes that his victims were presented in too sympathetic a light in court. That is the basis of his appeal. So I had to bring on Dr. Deborah Furholden, and I thought Dr. Deb would like to hear this. Dr. Deborah Furholden, I knew you'd want to hear this. We've got Attorney C.K. Hoffler with us to help break this down. This seems so unbelievable that the basis of his appeal is that the people he killed were cast into sympathetic a light. Can you explain that?
Well, good morning, Santita, and everyone else. It really is the inexplicable. But as with most people who are convicted, and most people just like, you know, Derek Chauvin, there's always going to be an appeal. They are always going to appeal either their conviction, the sentencing, especially if they are sentenced to death, to the death penalty. In this case, because of the magnitude and the gravity of the heinous crimes, for certain, the sentencing, I think, was appropriate, without a question. The major grounds for the appeal has to do with, and this is what he perceived as a trial error, the presentation of the victims. And quite frankly, there is no way that is too sympathetic in my book to present victims who were in prayer when they were massacred. But I don't want to say it's viable. I don't think it's going to have a chance. I don't think that there's a strong likelihood that that will succeed. But you should know that those are appealable grounds. When you are building your case as a prosecutor, and even when you're defending the case, but when you're building your case as a prosecutor, what you want to do is talk about the damages. In this case, the damage was to the individuals, to the families who lost so much, the individuals who lost their lives, the families who lost loved ones, and the loss to the community. And that is going to be very emotional, even if you're very sterile and not passionate in the presentation, because of the very nature of the heinous act that was committed. And of course, that is going to be something that is going to make people feel some kind of way. Again, because of the nature of the heinous act that was committed by the defendant. So I am certain that there was a flurry of emotion by just talking about and painting the picture of what he did. That's inevitable. That was going to happen no matter what. That was going to happen if someone just read an article about it. So that he is using that as a grounds for appeal is not surprising. I just don't believe that there's a likelihood of success. But we must be very, very careful here, because we have to look at who's on the courts. You know, when things are on appeal, you know, you've got to look to the judges on the courts. You've got to look to who they are appealing to. And sometimes it can be very dicey when you've got a lot of conservative people who are on the appellate courts.
Well, I want to know what everybody thinks about this. 773-763-9278. 773-763-WCPT. Call me. Tell me what you think about his appeal. I mean, his legal team has claimed that the prosecutors focus on the victim's good character meant the death sentence was improperly imposed. What do you think about that? Now, mind you, the police already took him to Burger King when they picked him up. They knew he'd murdered these people. They took him to Burger King because he was hungry. Now his legal team is saying, well, the prosecutors focused so much on the good character of people who welcomed a stranger into their service. They bowed their heads in prayer. He got up and started shooting everybody, killing everybody he could find. And apparently the last person he saw, who was not dead yet, he just looked at them and walked out the door. Hey, what is going on here? Now, mind you, we just saw the statue of Robert E. Lee removed yesterday. Yesterday, Robert E. Lee, who was the head of the Confederacy in the former capital of the Confederacy, they put up a statue there a generation after the Confederacy lost. And it's taken many more generations to get the statue removed. What do you think about this? 773-763-WCPT, 773-763-9278. It just sounded odd to me, Attorney C.K. Hoffler. Of course, every Wednesday, legal Q&A with C.K. on the Santita Jackson Show. She also has her own segment on her own show on WAOK, the iconic Atlanta radio station, but you can hear it everywhere, every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. Central Standard Time. What does this say? What does this say about where we are in the legal system and just in the culture, CK? Because it just seems to me, it seems like this was an attack upon the people who he killed. Portrayed them as good people. I mean, help me to understand. I don't understand this.
Well, because it's inexplicable. It's not understandable. So, but from some, just imagine, this is someone who committed heinous crimes in the worst of ways. Every crime is bad, but to kill people in the church while they're praying, you have to be some type of, in my humble impression, evil person. And he was not incapacitated. In other words, he was not deemed to be mentally incapacitated. He was methodical. He knew exactly what he was doing. He planned it with precision. He sat in the back of the church. He identified who he was going to kill, how he was going to kill him, when he was going to do it, how he was going to do it. So he was just demonic, in my impression. And it does not surprise me that this would be a grounds for appeal. But I want to put it in proper context. People will appeal anything when they're facing the death penalty. Anything. There are lawyers that take death penalty cases, and sometimes those lawyers just believe they don't believe in the death penalty. So they will seek to get it reversed simply because they feel the death penalty is unconstitutional. But I don't want to give you the impression that this is so unusual. If it weren't, this would be something else. I wasn't there at the trial, and I don't know. But as I said, by its very nature, when you talk about the victims and talk about what he did, it's going to incite emotion, which, by the way, it does in every case. When multiple people are shot and killed, when people are when you have cases when people are dismembered, with the type of precision that this criminal used to kill these people who were in worship, there's no question that there was emotion throughout the courtroom. But I don't think that is a strong ground, because just think about it. If you can't present basic facts of the victims, which you're required to do if you're a prosecuting case, then there's no way that it would not incite emotion. So did they go overboard? It really wouldn't matter. Is a life sentence an appropriate sentence given the heinous nature of the crimes? Absolutely. Is this going to be a significant grounds for appeal? I don't know that it will prevail, but these are the types of appellate issues that are raised. Should we be concerned? Yes. Why? Because you have to look at the appellate courts, and you have to recognize that the former president stacked the courts, the appellate courts, the federal district courts, with very, very conservative people who may have some of them, not all of them, may have racial animus. Let's just face it. And so we should be concerned, not necessarily just about this case, because I really think that he won't prevail on that issue on appeal, but you just never know. But we should be concerned in general. We saw recently what the U.S. Supreme Court did relative to the Texas anti-abortion law. We should be very concerned when we have these cases that are important to our community, when someone open fires and kills people while they're worshiping in one of our churches in such a heinous way, and then law enforcement stops by Burger King so he can be fully fed before he goes to jail. All of that should be of concern to us, and all of that is a commentary on where we are, not just in the legal system, but morally in this country. So, yeah, we have reason to be concerned.
That's what I think about. You know, let me just shift over here for a hot second. 24 House Democrats have now gone to Attorney General Merrick Garland, and they said, look, we need help with the reproductive, the attack on reproductive rights in Texas, because now you've turned the state into you have now created a class of vigilantes. Can you explain that? What happened with this law? Because anyone can sue a woman for having an abortion, right? And they said, you know, just anyone. But they believe that a whole class of vigilantes have been created. What do they mean by that?
Well, I don't know if you recall, when I first was speaking about this, I said a cottage industry is going to be created of people from all over the country who are going to make money, because a minimum of $10,000 a pop is good money for some lawyers and for some mm-hmm. law firms, particularly if they have, you know, thousands of cases. So this is going to be, I called it a cottage industry. But vigilantes, meaning people who feel very strongly, who are anti-abortion people. And I take no position on people's, you know, views on abortion. But people who are anti-abortion and who feel very strongly that this country is going, that they never believed in Roe versus Wade and that this is a breakthrough, they're going to want to push this, and they're going to want to be vigilantes. This law really enables vigilantes, people who are not necessarily, they don't even have to be well-trained, quite frankly, but lawyers and non-lawyers, just anyone, people, and they will get paid for reporting someone who is having an abortion. That is the vigilantism. But a lot of times vigilantes engage in illegal activity. This would be completely legal. That's the difference. And that's what's very disconcerting. The law enables anyone to do this. And in fact, will encourage people to do this, especially if people are hurting for money. Just find some woman who needs an abortion and trace everybody. And it's so easy to trace everyone around her. You can't sue her, but her mother, her father, her sister, her doctor, her nurse, her counselor, anyone that she touches. So now you might have to have private investigators who are following this person around and digging into her personal life so that they could sue her. That's what's going to happen. So that gives you the feel of vigilantism. But it's worse than that, because with vigilantes, sometimes they are brought to justice. They may be perceived in some communities being heroes because they, you know, go after the bad guy. In this case, they're not going after anyone who's a bad guy. This is a woman who feels that she needs to get an abortion, and everybody in her circle can be targeted. And it's awful. It's awful. So that's mm-hmm. what's meant by that. And I do believe, and I hope that the Justice Department does jump in, because the way to curb or to nullify these, whether it's voter suppressive laws and other laws like this, is to have a federal law, to have federal intervention legally that would trump, I hate to use that term, but that would supersede, if you will, or that could annihilate or neutralize some of these very, very draconian state laws. But it's a process. So I hope that the Justice Department does get involved. It's analogous to the voting rights, the need for the passage
of comprehensive voting rights legislation to neutralize what these states have done in terms of eroding the rights of people and imposing voter suppression.
Let me go to Jim from Chicago.
That's the analogy.
Absolutely. I mean, whew, this is the state of our legal system in the United States. Whew. Jim from Chicago, what's on your mind?
Hi. Good morning, Santita. The thing that I'm intrigued about is I'm not versed at social media. In fact, I think it's nuts. But the point is, this kid, did he communicate with other people to demonstrate that he can murder people? I mean, what his motivation? I can't understand his motivation. I can't understand where he would get these ideas where you're going to a church and kill people like that.
Oh, because
Did he think he was going to get some glory from it? I mean, my point is, it's a social media thing.
He felt that these black people were raping our women and taking over our country. It's a tale as old as the Republic. Actually,
I know, but did he share those stories with people on the internet? That's the only thing I'd like to know.
I don't know, but you don't have to do that. This is what happened with Emmett Till. I'd like to hear from you, CK, and I'd like to hear from you, Dr. Deb. Attorney Hoffler, I mean, you have vigilantes. I think that's why what's happening in Texas is so dangerous. You know, because Mrs. Carolyn Bryant's husband, and she has come and said it didn't quite happen that way. In other words, you know, implicitly, he didn't really have to die because, and of course, we've let her go. No one has pursued her to talk about how her husband savaged her husband and Mr. Milam savaged Emmett Till, savaged that child. We only know, only God knows what happened to him when they killed before they killed him. Jim makes a point. Who is he? What has produced him? Or should we be surprised?
We should not be surprised. It's the same forces that produced people who were lynching black people. It's the same thing. Some of the people who took over tried to take over the Capitol had the same type of racial animus. We should not be surprised. We should be horrified. We should be concerned. We should be distressed. But we should not really be so surprised that there are people in this country and elsewhere who believe that they need to annihilate black people because they perceive that we are raping their women and all of that. Or in the case of Emmett Till, just looking at a woman, at a white woman. So, you know, I think this should not be surprising. It should be very distressing and concerning. So we can draw parallels, absolutely, with what's happened now and what happened then and what happened since we brought over on slave ships to this country. This is not new behavior. It's not new behavior. It before was legally okay because black people were not considered humans. They were not considered full-fledged human beings. They were like chattel. They were like animals. And just as you could slaughter animals, you could slaughter a black person. So in this country, the legal system, if you will, the archaic system was not set up to really punish for that. Applaud, yes, but not punish. Now there are laws in place to punish and deter. And the punishment, while some people may disagree with capital punishment, that is what is available today. In the case of Emmett Till, well, you know, nobody really cared back then. This young black boy, they had all kinds of allegations that maybe he was, you know, looking at a black woman, attacking a white woman, or doing things that were improper. A mere look or glance was improper back then, enough to get someone killed. So Emmett Till was just thrown aside like a piece of trash, because at that time, that is how people perceived us. So the laws were in place to prosecute, but no one prosecuted because of the time. Today, the laws are in place. There was a prosecution that was successful, and there was a sentence that was imposed commensurate with the damage done. In a death penalty state, when you take a life, much less multiple lives, and when you have hate crimes like this, it is, whether you believe in death penalty or not, this is a penalty commensurate with the crimes. It's completely appropriate, as sad as death penalty or whether you believe it or not, as sad as it is, it's completely appropriate given the heinous nature of the crimes. What about the families of the people who were killed? What about that community? What about this country? What about African Americans, how we feel about this? So there are a lot of dynamics that are important, but those same dynamics existed when Emmett Till was alive. Those same dynamics have existed from time immemorial. It's just that the laws are now being enforced. Prosecutors are prosecuting more aggressively some of these cases. And so for the families, I don't know how they feel about the death penalty, but the legal system has spoken. And that's where we are with this.
Let me ask you this, because we still have Dr. Deb here, and she became a grandma last week. Little India is here. How do we explain this to Little India? How do we explain this to our children? How do we help them to function in a world that, you know, is still not completely safe for them? What do you say? CK?
Is that a question for me? Oh.
Yeah, I mean, you can answer it, Dr. Deb. I mean, because this is a lot.
Well, I fundamentally believe, and I don't know if folks have really followed what's called the Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Movement. It was born out of the truth and reconciliation work that was done in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And it's a woman here by the name of Gail Christopher. She is mighty and amazing. She worked with Nelson Mandela and other leaders in South Africa, and she brought that back to the U.S. And the fundamental sort of basis of Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation, or TRHT, is that in our world, we have placed a hierarchy on the value of human life. And that seems so strange, right, to think that you could put people on a pole and line them up, you know, based on things like race and whether or not they had a disability and their education and their color and their gender and all of that. And you could literally say your life is more valuable than yours, and yours is more valuable than yours. Yours is definitely less valuable than yours. But the basic premise is that's the world that we live in. Whether it's right or not, that's the world that we live in. And it shows up in everything that's important. You know, we talk about health disparities. We talk about the wealth gap and wealth disparities. And if you look, the system is working exactly as it was designed. So it's almost like a disruption to the conspiracy for somebody to have the audacity and put this right out on Front Street and say, hold up, hold up, hold up. Now, we all know that we don't see these people as equal to us. So all I did was rid the world of some of these people, and I'm operating true to the system that we all participate in. What's the big deal? It's really sick and saddening, but I can understand when you live in this country, especially as a white male, that you would almost think you've got a certain amount of cachet and superiority because that's how the system was set up, you know? And so that if we really want to heal and if we really want to have a transformation, we've got to first confront that and have a real honest and authentic reckoning with our history and our past so that we can pave something different for the future. You know, so what I would tell my granddaughter is this is the world that we live in, but it's not the world that we have to live in forever. We have to confront this. We have to deal with it, and it can be undone.
Absolutely. You know, and we have to also, you know, nod to all of the great civil rights icons, known and unknown, who have moved us along. We have made a lot of progress, everybody. We have. We just have much, 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 much further to go. The struggle continues. Remember that, everybody. Let's talk about what's happening in Texas. Let's talk about it. The attack on voting rights, the attack on reproductive rights. What will the Democrats do? And then what about productivity and jobs? Fewer workers are now producing more stuff. What does that mean? Back with more of the Santita Jackson Show in just a minute.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. everybody. Welcome to the Santita Jackson Show. It's Thursday, September 9th, 2021. I'm Santita Jackson, coming to you from WCPT, the nation's largest progressive talk radio station. Thank you for growing the show, everybody. Please continue to tell people about us and get everybody to tune in. Please have them meet our morning stars on the Santita Jackson and Friends page, the Santita Jackson and Friends page on Facebook. Everybody, Carol, a girl from my sister from the left coast, like and share. Dave Dowling, my brother from the north. Is it Bob Peters and Hannah from South Carolina, my dad's home state, and my brother Jesse Jr.'s home state. Norma Jean and Jewel and, oh my goodness, all of you. I missed you too. Desiree and so many of you. You're so sweet. I just love you, love you, love you. Please like and share this broadcast. Like and share and tell people about it. Bring more people into the family. Like and share, and also meet me on Twitter at Santita J, at Santita J, and also on Instagram, the Santita Jackson IG page, and of course, YouTube, the Santita Jackson Show channel. Please like and subscribe there. Like and subscribe. We've got to talk about what's happening in Texas. Will the Democrats fight back? Will they fight back? Got a lot to fight back. They can raise a lot of money, and they've been raising money, but are they fighting back against the attack on voting rights, the attacks on reproductive rights? What are they going to do specifically? And jobs and productivity. More people, fewer people are producing more stuff in America. And more people are not making as much money as they need to make. Got to talk about that with Dr. Max Wolf. Let's get to some of these headlines so we can get to Dave Daly in a hot second. Chicago, we're going to have a high of 73 degrees. Very comfortable today. Mostly sunny. Minneapolis, St. Paul, 76 degrees. Mostly sunny. The Dow closed down 68 points yesterday. The NASDAQ closed down 87 points. And the S&P 500 closed down 5 points. Tonight, our football season begins. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Buccaneers will be playing tonight. Will they be able to defend their Super Bowl championship? They're the first football team to play the Super Bowl in their hometown because of COVID. Wow, we will see. In Major League Baseball, the Twins were triumphant over Cleveland. They shut them out 3-0. The Cubs were triumphant over Cincinnati. 4-1. But the White Sox, well, they fell to the Oakland A's. You can't win them all, everybody. You can't win them all. They've been winning a lot lately. God bless them. Everybody, let's look at child hospitalizations. They've hit a high. As President Biden today will be unveiling a new plan to battle COVID. He's expected today to unveil a plan that will push for new vaccine mandates and testing programs as part of a revamped approach to ending the pandemic. The administration's six-pronged plan will focus on vaccinating the unvaccinated, further protecting the vaccinated through booster shots, and keeping schools open. In the meantime, he's doing that in this context. Daily U.S. COVID cases are up more than 300% from Labor Day last year. New Orleans has lifted the curfew imposed after Hurricane Ida wreaked havoc on New Orleans and Louisiana and that region, everybody, as electricity has been restored to most of the city, thankfully. Across Louisiana, however, more than 240,000 customers are still in the dark. To help with recovery efforts, the Carnival Glory cruise ship announced it has an agreement with New Orleans and FEMA to house hospital staff, first responders, and other emergency workers. Additionally, Louisiana's health department has revoked the licenses of 7 nursing homes that sent residents to a warehouse shelter and made them live in deplorable conditions, everybody. In a California recall, something we got to pay attention to, California Governor Gavin Newsom has been doing everything he can to persuade women to vote no on the Republican effort to oust him in Tuesday's recall elections. Really interesting election. Vice President Kamala Harris went in to help him in his efforts to hold on to his seat. And you know what? You have a black Republican, Larry Elder, very popular talk radio host, who could become the first black governor in California. Is that progress, everybody? Let me know. With 38 million people facing food insecurity, hunger in the United States soared by nearly 9% in 2020. House Democrats are urging the Department of Justice and the United States Attorney General Merrick Garland to prosecute vigilantes who will take it upon themselves to enforce the insidious anti-choice laws, voting law in Texas. Tax These Moochers. That's the headline in Common Dreams. The top 1% have dodged $163 billion in taxes each year. Wow, everybody. Did you know that? 2 million say that they were stopped without cause here in Chicago in the stop and frisk class action lawsuit. We're going to talk about that another day. I want to know what you think about that. Are you one of the 2 million in Chicago who was subjected to stop and frisk? Call me. Let me know. Oh, only in America, everybody. Let's talk about what the Democrats are doing, what they are and are not doing, as we look at what's happening in Texas. And really what's happening in Texas is happening all over the country. Fewer and fewer Americans are losing more and more rights. We're losing the right to vote, because we're losing access to the vote. Women and our reproductive rights are under threat. You're seeing that. We're going to see Roe v. Wade really face the Supreme Court, although the Supreme Court kind of let you know how they felt about it. And so people are wondering, where are the Democrats on all of this? They give a lot of great lip service, but what are they doing? Dave Daly from Fair Vote, the author of the best-selling Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. You got to get that book. And Rat Eft, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, everybody. He has written a new piece along with David Ferris. The GOP slow-motion coup is speeding up while Democrats choose to snooze. History will remember them harshly. David Daly, talk to us. What are the Democrats doing? What are they not doing?
Morning, Steve. Good morning, everyone. Boy. The Democrats, if what's happening across the country right now is not enough to spur the Democratic Party to act, if the slow-motion assault on voting rights emerging from state capitals around the country, if this late-night smothering of Roe v. Wade is not enough to make them understand the seriousness of this situation and the importance of urgent, immediate action while they still have majorities, honestly, I don't know what will. And here's the problem, right? No matter what Democrats pass out of the Congress, no matter what Democrats move out of the U.S. House over to the Senate, it's going to face a filibuster by Republicans. And no matter what they pass into law, it is going to face this U.S. Supreme Court. The options before them are to either acquiesce before Republican power and just admit that there's nothing that they can do, or they can go after the filibuster and enlarge the court and actually move an agenda that the American people voted for time and again in state after state. That they refuse to do any of this is mystifying. Their impotence at this point, frankly, is a policy choice. You might guess from what's happening that the Democrats are a weak minority party with few cards to play. They control the presidency. They control both houses of Congress. They're actually a weak majority party that refuses to play the cards that they have.
I don't understand what they're doing. And I'm hoping that what they're doing in California by deploying Elizabeth Warren, Vice President Kamala Harris, first African-American to hold a statewide office, more than one in California's history. I'm hoping that will be enough, but I just don't feel the energy on the ground. But if I listen to talk radio, if I look at Republicans, they are moving. They are moving, David Daly. They are moving. They are pushing. Who would have thought
they're playing the cards
that Larry Elder could become the... Yeah, but Larry Elder could become governor. I mean, now, mind you, California is a different kind of state, everybody, because it is as conservative as it is liberal and progressive. That's real. That is real. So, and I'm not mad about that. But, I mean, this is a man who's arguing reparations for white people. Come on now. What? What is that?
You know,
bless his heart, he has a right to an opinion, even though he is absolutely wrong. That having been said, I mean, and plus, we always pay reparations to white people. Ask the French, Okay, they got paid reparations for Haiti. So look, and so did slave owners here in the United States. That having been said, we snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. The Democrats do. I don't understand it. There's so much that they could be campaigning on, David. They could be rallying women from coast to coast. They really could. They could be rallying people from campus to campus on voting rights. I don't see any of that. I see them raise some money, but I don't see them dispensing it on the ground to getting people registered to vote. I don't see them doing anything.
I get a lot of emails from them encouraging me to, you know, give them $10 a month for something or other.
Does that move you? Do those emails move you, David?
No, those emails join all of the spam I get in my trash folder. I mean, listen, the Democratic Party's official policy, it appears to me, on voting rights is you have to out-organize and out-register and outrun Republicans. We just have to accept these rules and find a way to beat them. And it's as if saying we're going to strap on, a couple of rocks onto our back and run the same race, and we have to come out ahead. You can't out-organize voter suppression. You cannot out-organize the kind of extreme partisan gerrymandering that is going on. And you can't out-organize laws that are being passed in places like Georgia that would take election administration away from cities and give it to Republican legislatures. You cannot out-organize or out-vote or out-flank the kind of authoritarianism that is coming. It is constructed in such a way to withstand court challenges. It's constructed in a way to withstand even a majority of votes. What it does really is it enlists the filibuster and the electoral college and partisan gerrymandering and the rural small state bias of the U.S. Senate to give a minority of the country power over the rest of us. And Republicans are showing us what they're going to do, right? I mean, they're not hiding it, everybody.
But
what is on display in Texas right now is what's going to happen to us all. They're showing us what they're going to do and how they are going to do it.
I mean, but you wrote about this in RatEft. You said, no, they have a plan. They have a plan. And they've been enacting it for more than 10 years.
And the Democrats' plan is
what?
Try to out-organize it, guys.
I'm trying to figure out. You've got several of the most popular politicians, elected officials in the country are in the Democratic fold. Bernie Sanders, by many metrics, the most popular elected official in the United States. I don't care, to the right and to the left, he has tremendous appeal. You've got Elizabeth Warren. She has tremendous appeal. You've got Kamala Harris, who has appeal. You have President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama. They're the most popular people in the United States. Why are they not out here in these streets?
Leading rallies. I would like them to be active and speaking up, and I would like them to be using the power that they have to persuade Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema that the filibuster is a relic of the past, that it is simply an arcane Senate rule, that it has been changed hundreds of times in our history, that there have been exceptions and carve-outs, and that this moment, if they do not do a carve-out, we can see what is coming. If they can't find a way to restore the full protections of the Voting Rights Act in this moment, if they can't find a way to put an end to partisan gerrymandering and install some national common sense standards for election practices, rather than allowing these Republican legislatures to have their way and make their own rules, we are going to be in a heap of trouble in 2022 and then again in 2024, because what we saw on January 6th will just be the dry run. It will be the audition for what happens to our democracy in 2024. And if you think it can't happen here, you're not paying attention. You're not watching what is happening unfold in state legislatures. This is what they're up to. And if we do not stop it now, we will not be able to stop it then.
We're talking with David Daley, the author of the, oh, yes, is C.K. Hoffley. Hey, David.
Yes.
Yeah, C.K. Hoffley, who stayed with us. You know,
I stayed on, and I'm running late for my meeting, but I had to unmute myself. I was sounding like Lurch, you know. Well, David, when you were speaking, I was sounding like Lurch to myself. You know, Lurch on the Addams Family? Because I was just, you know. And the only thing I wanted to say, first of all, you know, David, I agree with all that you said. But there's another thing. Sitting here in Georgia, where there was such a great victory with our two new senators, and there was such enthusiasm. As I sit here today, I am so very concerned that Raphael Warnock, if we don't mobilize properly nationally, and, of course, locally, because locally they're doing a lot of organizing, but nationally, he may not get reelected. This is real. This is real. I don't know for the life of me why we appear to be afraid of the filibuster, why we are afraid of expanding the U.S. Supreme Court. You can't fail if you don't try. You can't win if you don't bet. So I'm very, very concerned and frustrated. And that's why I was sounding like Lurch. And I just thought I would unmute myself, Santita, to just express that I do agree. The enthusiasm with the superstar powerhouse Democrats that we have at each spectrum has to step forward, has to step out, because the American people voted all of these people in, and all of the people who are on the outside, who are not in the administration, but who wield so much power, have the unique ability to mobilize again. And we can't wait for another 6 months to do that. It has to be now, because it will be too late in 6 months. And this notion of being, we don't need to be gentlemen and gentlewomen about this. We need to be about the business of acting because of what's at stake.
Well, you know,
the heroic work that was done in Georgia in 2020, when those two U.S. Senate seats were won, January of 2021, Democrats said, if you give us these seats, we will have power and we will be able to use it. And now they're saying, we don't have enough power. You have to elect more U.S. senators in 2022 and give us even more to go out there and out-organize and outrun them again. And that is not a solution. It is not a plan. It is not a policy.
They're playing games, David. They're playing games. They're playing games. They're playing games because in 1986, in the middle of the Reagan Revolution, Reverend Jesse Jackson, who'd always been campaigning, didn't stop campaigning at 84. He ran from 84 through 86 through 88 and kept on going. That's how you got the White House in 92. That's how you got the Senate back in 1986. He kept running. I expect to see President Obama running. Right now, I expect to see the First Lady Obama running right now. I expect to see these popular people running right now. And I don't think that's too much to ask. We elected you. Now you need to represent me. And I don't want them to fight the Republicans, David. David, I don't want them to do that. Just fight for me. I could not care less about Mitch McConnell and his positions. I just know that my position needs defending.
Yeah.
And that's all I need them to do. Why won't they do it?
It doesn't matter who holds these jobs. You want them to be fighting not only for us, but for, like, the future of representative democracy. Because that is what is at stake here.
Absolutely. Give me a break.
What is happening around the country is clear and it is apparent. And Democrats have the power to stand up and stop it.
Why won't they? Are the numbers on their side? Please give us the numbers.
In what happens.
Give us the numbers. Are the numbers on our side? I've got 2 minutes.
The numbers are absolutely on the Democratic Party side. I mean, Democrats win 7.5 million more votes in the presidential race in 2020. They have 50 U.S. senators for both sides right now, but those 50 Democrats represent 41.5 million more people. The numbers are all in one place, and that is why Republicans have to enact this kind of rule rigging and voter suppression chicanery, is because they know that the numbers are not on their side. And so Democrats have had this attitude for a long, long time now that the demographics of the country are changing in such a way that they're going to have majorities in this country for a time eternal. And they've been saying this ever since Barack Obama got elected in 2008. And, well, you can see from the last decade and a half that that is not the case. And it's not the case because Republicans have effectively strategized to use these structures and rules that favor them. The structure of the Senate, the structure of the Electoral College, the method of appointing justices to the U.S. Supreme Court, they have used all of this to their benefit over the course of this time, and they have entrenched themselves in power in significant ways that they've put themselves beyond the reach of the ballot box. Democrats have got to ask themselves, what are they afraid of if they act? Are they afraid that Republicans will take power and do what? Go after the Voting Rights Act? Go after the Roe versus Wade? That's what they're doing right now, people. That's what they're doing right now. Stop it.
I'm wondering if, and you know, Paul, I'm a little hot. They're saying that I'm crackling. Bring me down just a bit. I'm wondering if they're afraid of the Republicans or if they are supporting the corporatocracy. When you come back, David, I want you to answer that question.
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe that's the one we need to answer. Everybody get unrigged. How Americans are battling back, how you must battle back to save democracy. And Rat Eft, if you want to see the plan, what we're living out right now, he wrote about this years ago. Get that book, everybody. Get both of them. Unrigged and Rat Eft. Dr. Maxwell talking about productivity and jobs. How is it that fewer workers are producing more stuff? They're not making a lot of money either. Back in just a minute.
For all the survivors, we can change the world. Change the world. Change the world.
Oh, yes, we can.
We can change the world. We can change the world. Change the world.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
War and hate to a place of love. It's not too late. Gotta save the children. We can't wait. Let's change the world.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Santita Jackson Show. WCPT 820, the nation's largest progressive talk radio station, and AM 950 Radio, the voice of progressive Minnesota, and the Santita Jackson and Friends page on Facebook and on YouTube, the Santita Jackson Show channel. I want you to like and subscribe on the channel, and please be my friend on Facebook, please. And, of course, at Santita J, please join me on Twitter and then Instagram, Santita Jackson IG, Santita Jackson IG. That's my official page, everybody. And please, think about Rainbow Push. You know, we need your support. I want you to go to rainbowpush.org and join us. And, of course, every Saturday morning, we are still doing our Saturday morning forum at 10 o'clock on the Impact Television Network and on rainbowpush.org. Let's talk with Dr. Max Wolf. You know what time it is on Thursday at the bottom of the hour. We always get a chance to get caught up on. We look at really social, political, and cultural issues through the economic lens when we're with him. And so I want to talk with you about productivity and jobs, right? I mean, I was reading something very, very interesting. I saw this headline, Dr. Wolf, "Will the pandemic productivity boom last?" That's from the New York Times. "For most of the last 15 years, the United States economy was mired in a period of low productivity growth. Who would have guessed that the pathway out of it might include a pandemic?" Yes, that is what the numbers show. Since the second quarter of 2020, late 2020, labor productivity, the amount of output per hour of work, has risen at least 3.8%. You know, and compared with 1.4% from 2005 to 2018. And more people, fewer people are making more stuff. And we still don't make a wage that that helps us to rent an apartment in the cities in which we work. Help me to understand where we are with productivity and jobs. You know, more and more people are saying, I'm not going back to the job I had before the pandemic. You have said that the world that we're coming back to is not the world we left prior to the pandemic. Help me, Dr. Wolf, help us.
Sure. So I think the productivity story is a big one because I think it explains part of why people are quitting, too. So as the rule book went out the window, and understandably so with the pandemic and the dislocations and pains and sort of surprises, the constant battering of surprises, you know, 20 months in almost now, and still kind of new surprises. The rule book went out the window. A lot of people lost their jobs, for sure, but the people who kept their jobs have been mercilessly and ceaselessly worked because you can't really go anywhere on vacation. You can't really come into the office. And so what people had hoped was work from home became live at work. And you see that in the productivity numbers, right? And everywhere else, you see this social distancing and pruning for the hard times meant overworking your employees to a whole new level. And that's the exhaustion and the fatigue. And that also speaks to a community of people, including highly paid professionals, who are worked so hard that they can't and don't probably, they have no way to process the pandemic and no way to deal with it because they're exhausted and they're always at work and they're probably pretty afraid of losing their job. Right. Because while there have been labor shortages, they've tend to be concentrated in lower wage jobs. And I think those have a different set of dynamics functioning in them when those dynamics have to do with once your employer seems somewhere between indifferent and open to the fact or open to the possibility that your job is life threatening, then $10, $12 an hour to risk your life starts to look kind of tough. Right. And even if there is a bonus offered, that becomes a daunting proposition. Right? And so I think the difference for the burnout and the bottom and the top might be different. And I also think, look, unambiguously, we had our mental health crises before all this, you know, before COVID. And there were ways we saw that, whether that was the sort of domestic violence issues or our shooting spree habit here. But or the opioids or what have you. But the level of psychiatric pain and dislocation is also really high. And if you put that together with sort of ceaseless burnout overwork, the days do kind of run together. And I think a lot of people, myself often included and folks around me, we kind of are living in this weird Groundhog Day with plague. I call it the Groundhog Plague Day scenario. And that takes a toll, all jokes notwithstanding, right? But it has not taken a toll on the productivity. And the reason we need to pay attention to the productivity means, as we've had a national debate and decided to make life more difficult for people who are out of work, to force these people back to work, we now have the evidence starting to come in. And the evidence is, in states and regions where the benefits were less generous or are less generous, fewer people have gone back to work. So it wasn't tough love. It was just tough, no love, and it failed. And the extent we've had an economic recovery, it's largely been led by the states with the benefits and the social safety nets, right? And so removing the benefits and the social safety nets no doubt did push some people back to work, but it doesn't seem to have pushed people back to work more than states who kept the benefits and the supports, one. Two, we're starting, which again, we have been talking about on your show for a long time, to see some of the damage from the fact that we now have the next wave of COVID running amok because we still can't get our people to give a crap about each other. And we could put it any way we want, but that's the problem. We can't get folks to wear those masks. We can't get folks to stay the social distance. We can't get folks to get the vaccine if they're healthy enough to do so and they don't have a good reason not to. Right? And we still have potentially hundreds of thousands or millions of people who aren't sure about what every doctor has to say, but if their cousin's uncle's girlfriend's vet
inject it, you know, thinks it might be a good time to try sheep dewormer, they're it.
But, you know, so, but also, Max, if you worked in a factory and your managers were taking bets on whether you and your brothers and sisters on the assembly line were going to get COVID. See, you know, there is just a lot of mistrust.
Or if they just didn't give you masks and separate you because it wasn't worth the hassle, even though it's virtually nothing and it could save the life of not just you, too, right? So that's the other issue here, your whole household. Because you come home sick and you live in a crowded household and you associate with a group of people, maybe of more than one generation, by the way, kids, elders, et cetera, you know.
Look, while we were told for months we didn't need masks, I mean, at the beginning, and that happened at the top, at the highest levels. We saw people doing that every day. So you have a lot. I mean, there is a lot that is off here. I'm trying to find out how it is that we are more productive with fewer workers. How does that work? How are fewer people making more stuff?
Working them harder.
Okay.
I mean, obviously there's a technology story here too, and the remote technology. And people are doing more with less resources. I mean, people don't always think of it this way, but as economists, we do. If you're working from home, you're the one paying the electric bill in the factory. It's your chair. It's your lighting bill. It's your internet bill. It's your notebook computer. It's your telephone. It's your air conditioner. It's your heater. It's your coffee machine, right? And you may not think about all that, but to the extent that you're providing all kinds of basic goods into the production process that used to be the cost and provision of someone else, namely your employer, then you're more efficient, right? The other thing is, if you can't say you're between meetings and you can't say you're traveling anywhere and you can't say you're going on vacation, you work all the time. And there's no real boundaries with the new technology. And so you get emails all the time and you get phone calls all the time and you lose the evenings and you lose the early mornings and you lose the weekends. And all of a sudden you're doing a lot. And then if you do have a job, last thing I think we always forget in the United States, which is we are kind of singular in the developed nations in doing this crazy thing, which is having people get their healthcare benefits from their job, which means in a health crisis, your employer could potentially kill you if they're displeased with your work.
Oh. Well, there's that.
Yeah, but that's a minor concern for a fair number of folks, right?
Yeah.
And they're not unreasonable to be worried. The point isn't that it's irrational or that to be unsympathetic or flippant, but yeah, I mean, your job is tied to your health care for a fairly large number of folks. And for those folks, the calculation about job always involves calculations about health care, particularly if they have themselves or have dependents who have, you know, serious conditions and chronic conditions, and or they've gotten close to a provider, physicians, clinics, and wonder or fear losing access to those physicians, clinics, treatments if they lose the job and with it the health insurance.
Will this productivity boom last?
I think we could have a slightly higher productivity. I think we will have a slightly higher productivity for a lot of reasons. I mean, rent is expensive, among other things, especially in the professional services world. I don't know if we'll continue to see the productivity growth, right? The other thing that causes me some concern is the mental health crisis does seem to be substantive and accelerating. And there is a lot of indication of pretty severe burnout in a lot of offices. And this is not accusing anyone of anything, but managing your workforce under these new conditions is also something that managers and employers have to learn. And while many are trying hard and probably doing great things, it just takes a while. It's just a different set of things you're trying to manage for your people. And even if you are making all the best efforts, and many are, and even if you do really care, and many do really care, you know, you have to learn how to play by the new rules. And there are new rules for everybody, and nobody really planned this. And this wasn't, ideally, if you're going to shift a regime, you have lots of study, and you experiment, and you learn, you try to figure out what's probably going to work in the new conditions. And if you have a sort of sudden catastrophic chaos give birth to the new conditions, which is what we had, then you don't have the benefit of any of that.
We're talking with Dr. Max Wolf, a brilliant economist, about productivity and jobs. You know, more and more Americans are leaving their jobs. Why? Is it because they're not making enough money, or are these benefits that they had been getting, these enhanced benefits, did that make them so rich that they just didn't want to go back to work? The minimum wage, according to CBS News, would be $26 an hour if it had grown in line with productivity. So why don't you tell me what you think the answer is? Where do we go from here, Dr. King famously asked more than 50 years ago, Dr. Wolf. I'm trying to figure out how we can have more productivity with fewer people working and how that's supposed to grow the society, advance the society, make us a civilization. How does that work?
Well, I mean, I think that's going to be one of the big things that's kind of on the spinning roulette wheel here socially, because I think we're a society at a crossroads. And I think you see that in the divide on a lot of key issues here, which is, are we going to try to learn the lessons of the rest of the world and learn the lessons of a critical look at our own past? Or are we going to try to force the future into the mold that makes us comfortable, which is mostly driven by framing of the past, right? So are we going to be the America that this sort of middle-aged suburban person, some of them, and that's painting with too broad of a brush, but sort of hoped America was for the last 30 years? Are we going to try to put the size 12 foot back into that size 6 shoe with all the cutting of toes and blisters and other pains that that will cause? Or are we going to try to get a shoe that fits us going forward? And I think we haven't decided as a society which way we're going to go. And I think January 6th tells us that. Election results tell us that. Texas rulings on reproductive rights tell us that. I mean, I think that we're not of one mind. And I think one of the weird ironies of the moment will be the mass of American opinion is on the side of the more progressive embrace of the future. Mm-hmm. And the mass of American political leadership is fully against it. And that has to do with low voter turnouts and disinterest and historical suppression and new suppression. So we have a whole new crop of 21st century voter suppression stuff. It's not all old fashioned or from the past. But we're going to have to decide what's worth fighting for. And I think that's the COVID story, too. I think you have to decide if the annoyance of a mask is more important to you than possibly killing a bunch of people. And unfortunately, a lot of our fellow citizens are deciding that it is.
Well, you know,
or that they'd rather not.
I think that we also have some cultural issues that people need to speak to, and we're not doing that. I think that we treat each other with a fair amount of disrespect and contempt. A lot of people have a lot of religious reasons for opposing mandates and for masks and all of that. There, I think that if we could open up a dialogue with each other to hear how people are thinking and to respect them. See, we've all politicized this on the left and the right, and I think it's all off because you still have people getting sick because we're not listening to each other. We're not talking to each other, and I think that is a problem. We're not listening to labor. We're not listening to labor. We just want to say people are lazy and they don't want to go back to work. No. They're not willing to go back into a situation in which they are disrespected. They are not willing. They'd rather drive Uber, Lyft, or something, babysit something, than go into situations where they're never going to get ahead, Max. There is no prosperity wage. We're trying to get to 15.
I think a lot of people are going back to work, and we're not seeing it. So the other problem, you know, and I know I've mentioned this other times, so not to sort of beat this drum endlessly, but the other problem is the legitimate, visible portion of the American society and economy is shrinking. More and more of life is in the shadows.
Yeah.
So the measures that we have and the understandings that we have, they mostly come from official statistics. And official statistics tend to pick up the sort of official economy, official people, right? So we know, for instance, illegal immigrants are really hard to count because they're not really officially here, right? Homeless people are really hard to do a census on because they don't have an official address, right? People, the society under recognizes and under counts are hard to count, right? And as the official job market excludes or doesn't have a exciting or supporting or sustainable, you know, or living wage place for a lot of people, they drift off. And we call them unemployed, and some are, but many are not. right? Many are working quite hard doing things that for any number of reasons aren't going to be reported. You know, and people's minds tend to go to the sort of darkest criminality. And sure, there's, we do not suffer from a lack of crime or criminals in the U.S., nor have we historically. But it's mostly stuff that's a lot less exciting, that doesn't lend itself to Hollywood so much, right? So it's mostly not that people's part-time job is selling the trinkets they take as serial killers, even though that might be interesting at film. It's more like they're kind of fixing the neighbor's cars for cash, which is a little bit less dramatic, right? Or babysitting for someone else's kids so they can work when the schools are closed, right? Or cleaning someone else's or other folks' house, or cooking dinner for a bunch of people and throwing it out of the window, right? Again, all these things are probably less likely to be optioned for the film rights for a bunch of reasons, right? So, you know, burritos from Window 3B is probably not going to be a blockbuster summer release 2022. But it probably employs a lot more people than being a drug kingpin,
but,
right? And so,
I guess my question is also, because I think that you're absolutely right, where are we going with all of this? I mean, I go into more and more stores, and they have fewer cashiers. So somebody's making money. People are not, right? We have
productivity is rising.
Yeah, and no people are working. So that means no wages,
right?
No health insurance in a pandemic.
Well, the stock market's nicely up, setting records, right? So you can see the profit. That's the mix, the social mix between wages and profits has been pretty monotonically tending. So it's consistently, tending toward higher profit over the last 40 years. And that's kind of accelerated in the downturn.
And
the
fewer
downturns.
More profits, fewer workers. How is that supposed to work? I mean, how are we going to advance
people
the living
who are
like that?
Working. The only thing I'm trying to say is a lot of people who are working, but they're not classified as workers. They're independent contractors. But I just want to make sure that people understand those people are working.
You're right. Because you got to eat.
Because we get a social discussion.
You don't have health
about
insurance.
Being late. Absolutely. You don't have any rights. Right.
Yeah.
And you're not recognized often in statistics. So all I'm trying to say is your day still starts at 6 a.m. and you come home bone weary often at 8 or 9 p.m. So by what most real people mean when they say working, you're working, right? But what the statistics are going to tell us is that you're not working. You don't exist. It's not you're unemployed, right?
Yeah.
You probably don't exist. Or worse yet, maybe you're seen as some, you know, small business owner, independent contractor. And in some cases, that's correct. But a lot of cases, probably not. Yeah, and so you have what we call the, you know, what I think others, so I didn't make the term up, but it's sometimes nicely called the precariat, right? So they're not the sort of workers of old. They're people who have precarious little places in the economy where they can do a bunch of work or let someone else use their property, Airbnb or what have you, to try to make the rent, try to go to the grocery store, try to get the kids ready for back to school, whatever it is, right? But those people tend not to really show up. And the reason that's so important, just so people understand, is it means we don't know what's going on with them. We undercount their suffering. We underprovide them benefits. They don't have labor force protections. And when things happen to them in the economy, it doesn't show up, good or bad. And so good things happen to them, too. It doesn't tend to show up in our statistics. And it sort of means that the we have the wrong prescription on the glasses, right? Because that's our job if you're a social scientist, you know, focus the lens, let people see what's going on. If you have the wrong prescription, so if you wear glasses, which you may have guessed I do, if you pick up someone else's glasses and look around, it's usually not such a crisp view.
Where do we go from here? Where should we be going from here? Maybe that's a more specific question.
I mean, that's a collective decision. I do think COVID is a great opportunity in a weird way to see if we can care about more than ourselves, think about long term, believe we have a future, and believe we can work together to get there. Because we continue to have a much worse problem with COVID than a lot of other similar countries because we cannot at least behave like we care about each other. We are not good at that in this country. And I don't mean we men or we women or we Northeast or we Midwest or we South or white or black or, you know, I just mean sort of the collective we, right? And the mental stress and the anguish and the difficulty of COVID, which are real, need to be acknowledged too. This is very difficult. Doing the right thing is very difficult. Those people who wear a mask every day, even if it's uncomfortable, and wash their hands and try not to do anything they don't have to do and try to help other people, those people are heroes, and they're grinding it out 21 months into this without that much help and without much recognition. And that's a tough mile to walk.
Absolutely.
And we need to acknowledge that too. It can't be just negative on the people who fall down. That's the wrong way to go, right? And if the whole point is to get as many people to walk across that finish line as possible, then berating and spitting on the folks falling down is not good use of energy or time, right? So my point isn't to, be venal or punish the folks who aren't making it, but they do need to make it. We need to help them make it to whatever extent that's mm-hmm. possible, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's my point about these culture wars that we have now over vaccines, over masks, and on and on and on. I was talking with a very dear friend of mine, and I'm going to give the last minute to you. She said, and she is, very, very prominent, a very prominent physician. And she said, I had real issues with people who wouldn't mask, who wouldn't vaccinate and all of that. And then I found out one of my dear friends was in the same space, and she and I almost had a falling out until I talked to her. And I listened to her. I said, you've got some points, some of which I agree with, some of which I disagree with, but I hear you now. And I guess when I look at workers, when I think about people, when I'm walking around here at 4:45 in the morning, 4:30 in the morning, and I see some people standing on the bus stop across the street from my own, and I think about these people, and I said, where's the love for them? And you make the point, Max, Dr. Wolf. These folks are working. People are working. They're just off the grid, which means if you're off the grid, you do not have health insurance. You do not have the social protections that you need and that you deserve. I've got 1 minute. It belongs to you, Dr. Wolf.
So I do think we need to talk to each other, but I do think we need to talk to each other through those masks.
Oh,
right.
Hey.
But I also think that the period of time in which, talk loud if you need to. And if you have a real health condition, if you're part of that half of 1% who has a real health condition, God bless you. Take it off and stay home unless you absolutely can't. Mm-hmm. Right. So you do have to come correct to be heard. I do think we need to kind of underline both of those in the society, right? The society needs to hear you out, but you need to come correct. At least that's maybe a New Yorkism, and it's probably not correct grammar, but you need to come correct, right? So I do think both those things matter. But I think we're at the point where the people who care about each other and want to build a future and can focus on it need to take over. Not putting anyone else down, not giving anyone a hard time, but we can't have a future without that. And we need to have a future with that. And I think that's the challenge of the age, more than race or politics or age or anything else. Can you focus on the future and try to get there with other people? Or are you lost in your own kind of socially unaware personal plan of success? I think that's the cleavage of the age.
Come together, everybody. Come together. Let's come together. Come on, everybody. We can do this. We're one people. We're one world. Let's work it out, everybody. Dr. Max Wolf, brilliant economist, my dear, dear friend. Everybody, I love you. I'll see you tomorrow as we commemorate September 11th. What happened then? Where do we go from here? Let's talk about it. Talking about these workers tomorrow, Dr. Wolf, who are suffering with cancer, people who live down there. We've got to talk about this tomorrow on the Santita Jackson Show. God bless you, everybody. Save the children.